From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we continue our film series with a compelling and original documentary. Here are the basics. In July of 1917, in the copper mining town of Bisbee, Arizona, striking miners, mostly immigrants, were loaded into cattle cars and left in the desert to die. The filmmaker Robert Green went to Bisbee, and he ended up recreating the story. He also managed to dredge up some ghosts. We'll be right back.
Take KUER wherever you go with our mobile app. Listen to a live stream of the station, get the latest stories from NPR and the KUER newsroom, or explore the newest Radio West podcast. You can even access our 24/7 streams of classical music and the BBC. It's not just any app. It's the KUER app, available for Android and iPhone wherever you get your apps.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. As a documentary filmmaker, Robert Green has this decidedly unique approach. He sometimes recreates scenes, basically reconstructs something that happened in the past as a way of helping viewers, as he's put it, imagine the internal lives of real people. One of Green's films is about a local TV newscaster in Sarasota, Florida, who killed herself on live television. This was back in 1974. And so he cast an actor to play this newscaster, and much of the film was about her preparing to play this role. In Green's latest film, he does something similar. He enlists the people of Bisbee, Arizona, to reenact a moment of violence that played out one day in July in 1917. Bisbee used to be this prosperous copper mining town, and in the summer of that year, the miners who had been organized by the IWW, that's the International Workers of the World, the Wobblies, they went on strike to protest working conditions and pay. By July 12th, the mining companies had had enough. The local sheriff deputized some of the townspeople, and they basically went through Bisbee rounding up the workers and their supporters. They were marched to a local baseball field where they were forced into cattle cars and then taken into the brutal New Mexico desert and really left there to die. The story, which has become known as the Bisbee deportation, had been buried for years, and Green says it still haunts the town. So at the anniversary, the 100th anniversary of the 1917 deportation, Green cast people in town, and he recreated the deportation. His film is called Bisbee 17, and we're going to be screening it next week as part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with Utah Film Center. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting our conversation with Robert Green. We talked with him at the Sundance Film Festival last year. Green had been visiting Bisbee for years before he made his latest film, and when we spoke with him, I started by asking why. Why Bisbee, Arizona?
My mother-in-law, actually, at the time, she wasn't my mother-in-law, but my future mother-in-law bought a place because she's a historian herself, and you know, she, you know, falls in love with these towns and these places, and Bisbee is a place that she went to check out just for its history, and fell in love with the place and bought like some land there where we had two houses, and I went there with my future wife to basically work on the house, to strip the floor and do all that stuff. And it was sort of early in our relationship, so it was kind of romantic. And we walked down Tombstone Canyon and went to the Mining and Historical Museum, and there was this book called Bisbee 17, which was a dramatization, novelization by Robert Houston about the deportation. And this was 5 or 6 years before I made my first feature. It was just a story that blew my mind. And I immediately thought, hey, you know what we should do is work with the locals to recreate the deportation. But we'll never
be able to. Not as a film. You just thought,
No, I wanted to do it as a film. But there was like no way to do it. I mean, I had no idea. And the idea was just there from the beginning. And I always, as I moved forward making films with the company I work with, Fourth Row Films, the old joke was either I'm going to succeed at making films and go back to Bisbee and make the film, or I'm going to fail at making films and have to live in Bisbee. That was the that was the thing. So I was happy that it was the former.
Yeah. You say when you first heard that story, it rattled you. That's how you described it. It rattled you. Would you talk about your reaction to it? Talk about that.
Yeah. I mean, when you come of age, you know, so I was – this is 15 years ago. I was, you know, in my 20s and you start to see the world sort of for what it is, right? And then you realize that you know, you're not part of an – everyone imagines themselves to be sort of a part of maybe a revolutionary idea. And in the early 2000s, there were, you know, we're in the Bush years and people were pissed off and were thinking about things. But then this is what Howard Zinn's works about, you know, the secret, you know, the labor, the story of labor in America, the story of radical ideas in America. There's buried story after buried story. And there were a few sort of major revolutionary moments that could have happened in the 20th century. And the 60s are one, the 30s are one, and around the time of the start of First World War was one. And it just – the drama of it and the fact that I never heard of it and that we're not told any of these stories. Yeah. And the way democracy and capitalism works is it seems to be this thing that's – it's inevitable. It's rolling downhill and it's inevitable and there's nothing to do about it. But in fact, there was several moments where something could have been done about it. Yeah. Something could have been done to make changes. And specifically here, these were – Bisbee was known as a white man's camp. And there was discrimination throughout the mines. It's a very complicated thing because Bisbee was also some of the highest paid miners in the world.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, it was a sort of dangerous, crazy place to be. And when the war started, it was all ratcheted up because suddenly Bisbee was super important to this new era of the U.S. being, you know, going for global power. So it's all these things. It just and the sheer drama of it. And really what it did for me was explain the ghosts in this town.
Yeah.
I don't even know if I believe in ghosts, but I know that if I walked – I believe in ghosts in Bisbee. You know?
Right, right.
There's no doubt in my mind.
Well, that idea of a place being haunted, whether you literally believe in that, although some do in town as we see at moments in the film, but the idea of a town being haunted, even emotionally, by these ghosts, that seems to be a theme.
Well, look, there's haunted means two things. Haunted, the first version of haunted is, you know, there are two giant holes in the earth where mineral energy is coming out of the ground. That is not fake. That is energy actually coming out of the ground. Those minerals have electromagnetic energy. That you feel that. You still feel it today. Those mines are not dead.
Yeah.
And there's the other version of haunted, which is this is a town where the mines closed in 1975. So it is not a town with an industry anymore. In fact, people don't have to live in Bisbee. There's no real reason. People live in Bisbee because they want to live in Bisbee, because they love the community. They love the landscape. They love the feeling of being there. So a ghost town often just means people performing the idea of ghosts. They need to do that for the tourist dollars, and that's what keeps a place like Bisbee alive. So it's a combination of real energy and this sort of fake performance of something that is supposed to be, you know, ghostly or whatever and haunted, but really it is just to bring people in to keep the town alive. The ghosts are keeping the town alive.
You said that you did not make this film with the intent of making some sort of statement about the Trump administration and all the controversy over immigration. But the timing was weirdly fortuitous.
And
you can't help but make some kind of connection there. So I wanted to ask you about that, because what's so fascinating about the documentary is how the present, like present ideas, the way people think, bleeds into the past.
Yeah, I mean, the film does not take place in 1917. The film uses recreations and dramatizations, but those are. More like interventions into reality or something. They're not escapist sort of documentary recreations in any traditional way. The film is not a 1917 film. It's a
right.
2017 film. And when I say that we didn't intentionally think about Trump, we started shooting in October 2016. The film was – the story and telling the story was just as relevant before Trump. And then a month later, the volume – the heat on the thing almost was felt like it could have spilled over a little bit, because we were worried almost it was too much. Like,
yeah.
In other words,
yeah.
if the original idea from the beginning was we have to recreate this thing, and that means we didn't know who that meant, where we'd be working with at the time, but we knew that we'd be, you know, going there, you know, with people and trying to get people to imagine what it was like to go through this. If you're doing that when people are being pulled out of 7-Elevens and you recreate a scene where someone's pulled out of a convenience store, it's dangerous.
Yeah.
It's actually dangerous. And you know, we had to be ready for that.
It's interesting that you have these differing points of view in Bisbee. Like any town has, you know, you've got the conservatives and they feel a certain way about things. And then you have those who are more activist. And it seems like Bisbee is full of this real diversity of opinion. Like it seems like a beautiful place, but it seems really funky and really all over the map in terms of the way people think.
Yeah, people generally consider Bisbee like a blue dot in a big red sea of Arizona, yeah. Politically. Tombstone, just 20 miles away, is where the freedom fighters and the, you know, the Minutemen came from. So it's a tale of two cities in some ways. But the truth is that the makeup of Bisbee, there's still plenty of old mining families that are there. And there's plenty of conservative and liberal Hispanic families, Mexican-American families that live there. And so there's a great diverse opinion. And what happens is, as we say in the film, the people who stayed in Bisbee were the people who weren't deported from Bisbee.
Right.
But then you have, you know, artists and bikers and hippies and weirdos and people who are just trying to get away from everything come into town. And every one of them, I think, has an experience at some point, this similar experience that I had just visiting, that you learn about this tragic event. And that creates a sort of schism in town between this thing that was buried and these new people coming in and want to know the answers. And that's sort of two sides thing mimics what was going on 100 years ago.
I want to ask you about just the concept for the film itself. And the thing that occurred to me, I'm just trying to imagine the timeline, because you go in and we'll talk about how this worked, but you enlist the townspeople as extras in this recreation. But you have to shoot it on the anniversary of the deportation, which is July 12th, 2017. That can't have been far off from the deadline for Sundance. So talk a little bit about the turnaround, how you – and the stuff that we're seeing that's so powerful took place on the 12th.
Yeah.
Or in those moments after, I'm guessing. So how did you manage that, just turning the sucker around?
We're insane. I mean, this is like, I mean, and honestly, like the truth is when we started the project, I was on the sort of theatrical tour for Cape Place Christine, and just happened to be trying to think of anything else other than that film. Is what happens to you when you're in that position.
Yep.
And I was just like, oh wait, has anyone made the deportation movie yet? It's the movie I've been wanting to make forever, and I've tried to make it all these different ways over the years. And I was like, oh, okay, it's the 100th anniversary. Called my wife first, because she was like, you have to take a break after Cape Place Christine, because I had just been going and going and going. But I knew she wanted to make this film too.
Yeah.
And she's such an important collaborator creatively and otherwise. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, said, hey, I got to talk to everybody about this film. And she's like, okay, we'll do it, you know. And so, because we knew immediately that if that was the idea hitting that day, that we'd be up against it. But I mean, the fact is I have an amazing team. We you know, I've worked with Doug Tarola, Susan Bedusa, and Bennett Elliott, my producers, for years. I've known Jared Alterman, the director of photography for years. Many of my students worked on the film from the Murray Center of Documentary Journalism at the University of Missouri. So that was amazing. So it was a family thing. And that helps a lot. And plus, I'm the editor of my own film, so I'm shooting for the edit in a way. The movie's crazy ambitious and has all like way too many characters, and it's all over the place. But it was, I knew we had a fighting chance. I like to work fast. I think a lot of filmmakers work too slow and overcook their things, and I like to go fast and leave the flaws in there. And so people who see the film maybe thinks I left too many flaws in there, but you know, here we are.
I want to talk about the style when we come back from a break. But let me ask you, just how difficult was it? You've talked about how the town had basically buried this thing. And it's as it's reflected in the film, it's difficult to talk about. So how did you get people to participate? How did you get people to come along with you?
Well, Bisbee is a place like any health, you know, place really that healthy place with good attitudes about outsiders is suspicious of people. I would say anyone and everyone should be suspicious of documentary filmmakers because like they can be creeps. But you know, so I knew that it would take several trips to sort of explain ourselves to the town, and it didn't hurt that I knew the town. And I think once Bisbeeites see that you know the town, it changes. You know, once you know not just the town, like the landscape or the roads or how to get from here to there, but the feeling of the town and how to talk to people.
Yeah.
But it was really just like slowly meeting people, explaining the idea. The thing about recreations in Bisbee is Tombstone, like I said, is 20 miles away, and they do recreations every day, and
it's
Bisbee,
what they do. Yeah,
it's all they do.
Yeah.
and which I love, but still Bisbee proudly defines themselves as not Tombstone. So the idea of recreations, I really had to explain that we're not trying to trivialize, it's about the people that are doing it, and no one's going to watch this and think that's Harry Wheeler. They're going to think that's Richard Hodges playing Harry Wheeler, and what does that mean? And I think, you know, basically once people started telling us their stories, we started saying, hey, well, you have this story. Would you like to try this? And some people said no, and we were lucky that many people said yes.
That's Robert Green. He's the director of the documentary film Bisbee 17. We spoke with him last year when the film premiered at the Sundance Film Festival. We're going to be showing it next week, next Tuesday evening, not Wednesday, as we usually do, but Tuesday night at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. This is part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Robert Green is going to be there for a Q&A after the film. You can get details on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Do you work for the University of Utah? Are you a public radio nerd? Then donate to KUER through payroll deduction. Decide how much of your paycheck you'd like to put toward programming like Morning Edition, 1A, and Radio West, and the university will send your generous gift to KUER. Your contribution supports factual journalism, Utah stories, and even short films. Get started with payroll deduction by looking under the support tab at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting a conversation we had last year about a compelling and original documentary film. Here are the basics. In July of 1917, in the copper mining town of Bisbee, Arizona, striking miners, most of them immigrants, were loaded into cattle cars and dumped in the desert to die. The filmmaker Robert Green went to Bisbee, and he ended up recreating the story using real people from the town. Along the way, he managed to dredge up some ghosts as well. The film is called Bisbee 17. We're going to be showing it next week as part of our Through the Lens documentary film series. We spoke with Robert Green when the film premiered at Sundance last year. I want to ask you about the style of the film, where you basically break down, you know, what is known as the fourth wall. We see the camera guys moving around. We, as you say, You're not trying to recreate 1917. We see 2017. We see the stores. We see cars driving by. Talk a little bit about that part of it, the way you just break down the process itself, because that seems like an important technique for you.
I really, really dislike traditional documentary reenactments. I think that they tend to eliminate the nuance of reality, and that's what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to bring a story to life in some ways, but when they're done well, they make you think about storytelling basically, and they make you think about how narratives are constructed and how the individuals within the frame are constructing those narratives and how the filmmakers are constructing those narratives. And this is a story that is about, you know, ultimately when you're trying to tell a story that comes from all these different sides, we're telling the side of the people who think this was akin to the Holocaust. We're telling the side of the people that think this was completely justified because Bisbee's existence was threatened. the idea is not to try to find some sort of objective, okay, here is the whole truth. The idea is to explore storytelling and explore how that, you know, sort of goes from 1917 to now, and how replaying this and working through this can actually help us understand the way we create narratives. Because the thing that's happened, what Trump is a creation of a narrative, right? Like he's creating this narrative. I mean, that's all he is. I mean, there's not even substance behind it. It's just a basic nothing but creating of a narrative of what America is and what it isn't. And seeing people, you get to know them as people. You get to see what their relationship is or is not to the deportation and the story, and then and the mining town and Bisbee and their own lives and how it echoes through their lives. And then you see them, you know, recreate this thing. You're never taken – it's never supposed to say, okay, here's 1970. We're always, always in the present tense.
Yeah, and we see them make mistakes. We see them referring to the camera. We see them from time to time starting again. And I have to say the pacing of the film – this is very much your style. There are moments when some of the people in the film are looking at the camera and then they address the camera. Mm. And it's a kind of a beautiful technique. I just wanted to ask you about that, where they introduce themselves basically to us as the viewers.
Yeah, that's – I mean, for me, Bisbee, like I said before, is a place where – like I like to think of it this way. Bisbee is a place where you imagine yourself to be in Bisbee. It's so in a sense, everyone's on stage in a way. Everyone imagines themselves to be people who live in Bisbee. That's not uncommon for places, right? Like New York City, a lot of people come to New York City because they imagine themselves to be people who live in New York City.
Right.
Bisbee is one of those places, and which means that people feel almost like they're a part of a story in a sense. So what we wanted to do was bring out the sort of theatricality of it. Documentary interviews often are meant to do everything but acknowledge the complete artifice of the interview, right? So when you hear about what documentary objective truth and reality and all this other stuff, oftentimes people are talking about things with interviews in them, you know, and interviews
are totally artificial.
They're the most staged artificial thing imaginable.
Exactly,
and so, but bringing that out is part of just telling the story of a type of collaboration. You know, we didn't invade people's homes. We were invited in, and invited in because they wanted to tell their story.
Yeah.
So they're asking to be put on the stage. We're providing that stage. And that's a two-way collaborative thing. At the same time, the pauses before people speak, in my mind, there's many moments in the film where there's just a beat, or sometimes much longer than a beat, of before people speak. That's where ghosts exist.
Yeah.
You know, that's that space where you're not sure what you're watching, you're not sure what the awareness is, and there's something like almost unwieldy and like creepy about it.
Yep.
And I was happy to sort of discover that rhythm as we made the film.
I want to tell a couple of the stories in the film if we can. Let's start with Richard Hodges, who's terrific. What is he? How tall is that guy?
Several feet tall. Yeah.
He's over
6'3", 6'4".
He's really tall, and he's playing in the film one of the sort of the, I guess, the bad guy, although it's not entirely clear that, seems like a bad guy to me, but that's in dispute in the town. It's the sheriff who rounded up these people. And as Richard explains in this moment from the film, we get a sense for how both sides of this story are present there in Bisbee.
Yeah, absolutely. Richard, his story is that he has people on both sides of the deportation. He's deeply embedded in the town. His family have been there for generations. So he knows it in his heart.
I had family on both sides of the deportation, both from the mining company standpoint and from the miner standpoint. I had a cousin that was a miner. He lived up in Old Bisbee, and he was rounded up with the rest of the miners. They figured that it was one of these deals where the mining company was just trying to flex their muscles and intimidate them. When they brought in the rail cars, they realized how serious it was. When they were disconnecting the train, the deputized foremen were telling the miners, if we ever see you in Bisbee again, we will kill you. Cousin said he reached through the rail car and grabbed one of the deputies that he knows and held him, told him, no, Bisbee is my town. I am going to come back to Bisbee. I am going to kill your family in front of you, and then I'm going to kill you. And I believe he meant it.
This gives you a sense of the intensity of that story. It seems like the original people from Bisbee, they all have that kind of conflict in their families, it seems like, or a lot of people did.
Plenty of people did, yeah, absolutely. And what I like about that clip, it also shows the storytelling aspect. He's clearly told that story many times over his life. And so there's this tension between it being a buried secret in town and something that was passed on.
Yeah.
And important, he always talks about Richard talks about, I think, one family member. I don't remember who it was exactly, but someone, when he first learned about the deportation, was in the 60s, and someone was explaining it to him. And he thought, oh, well, this must have happened yesterday because of the intensity of how his well, this family member was explaining it to him. And he's like, no, this happened 50 years ago. And he and that stuck with him. The intensity stuck with him. And you know, he really embraced playing Harry Wheeler because, like you said, Harry Wheeler was a complicated guy. Harry Wheeler imagined himself to be a sheriff on the Old West. He was the captain of the Arizona Rangers before he was the sheriff of Cochise County. He sort of was playing a role of
that he got from a dime store novel, as one of the people in the film
says. Yeah, basically, well, the line from the great Robert Houston, who wrote Bisbee 17, is cowboys learn to be cowboys by reading cowboy novels, which if that is the kind of idea that goes straight to my soul. I love it so much. But then seeing him then portray a character that he has mixed feelings about and see him working through that is sort of the, one of the foundational things that's happening in the movie.
There is a family in Bisbee, and sort of the matriarch of the family now is Sue Ray. Her grandfather, Wesley, and her uncle, Archie, were in both two sides of this story. Basically, what happened is her grandfather, Wesley, was deputized by Sheriff Wheeler, and he went to Archie's house and he rounded him up and he put him on the train. And in this moment from the film, we hear her and we hear Stephen, her son, talking about those both sides, how you had to pick a side, and how they feel conflicted. They're trying to relate to both sides. And this is a theme in the film. Let me play this moment so we can talk about it.
I was really shocked when I first heard that Grandpa arrested Uncle Archie. They had to go with what their conscience told them.
Yeah.
And what they had been told helped them to decide which way they were going to go. Am I going to go to the right or am I going to go to the left?
Well, I mean, I agree. I can understand and sympathize both sides.
I am very proud of my grandfather. He felt he was responsible, along with those that worked for the company, to make certain that we were protected from becoming taken over by the socialists, by communism, that he had to go and arrest his own brother and send his brother out into the unknown world, not realizing that they would never see each other again.
It's so interesting the way, what I love, Stephen is her son, and you hear him there just a bit, and then she has another son named Mel. And they're both, I think, they play these really important roles, not in terms of the way they speak, but what we see in the film. Because throughout, they're playing these recreated pieces, and they feel conflicted. Because in some ways, they want to be on the side of the town. They want to be on the side of the mining companies. But then they feel conflicted, and we see it reflected in the roles that they play throughout this film. Would you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so Sue Ray wanted to tell her story for years, and when we arrived, she saw this opportunity. And what I love about that clip is, and I think the conflicted nature of it is you point out is correct. But what Sue Ray is saying there is that in 1917, what they were told, it's an important line there, what they were told forced them to decide between the right and the left. And then she goes on to use words like socialism and communism in ways that are just basically fast forward to
today.
Yeah, to or even the 1950s right. or the 60s about what we were told communism yeah. and socialism was, right? Yeah. The industrial workers of the world were not communists or socialists. They were anarcho-syndicalists. It's a very specific ideology which has things in common with socialism, of course, but it's not. And what I love about that is it reveals to me that it was the propaganda of the time that forced people to choose sides. And when we talk about today being one of the most divided times of our lives, that's not untrue. But why? Why are we divided? We're divided because forces are dividing us, because forces are gaining power by dividing us. And that's embodied in the Ray's story. I mean, you know, I don't believe two brothers, you know, they didn't hate each other. They were doing what they thought was right. And even when Sue, at the end of the movie, as she's preparing Mel to round up Steve, and to me, it's very clear, it's not Les and Archie, it's Mel and Steve. She puts the armband, which signifies that Mel has been deputized, and she says, "This gives you special authority." That is the creepiest moment of the movie for me, because it's unscripted, and it's Sue Ray truly identifying with that moment, and I can't shake it, because we pick teams so easily in this country, yeah. And that's what we end up doing, is it becomes team sport, and then we end up dividing families and sort of ruining what this country could be.
Okay, so let's talk about how Dick Graham plays into this. He seems there are moments when I think he's not conflicted at all. But then there are other moments, and we'll get to that a little bit later, where he might be. I don't know. It's really interesting. Now, Dick is from a mining family. He was president of what mine?
He was the president of the company. I believe he was president of the Phelps Dodge. But he doesn't – the way he talks about it, which is very specific, I was president of the company.
Yeah.
And I would even ask him, and he was like, I was president of the company. Mm-hmm. So it's a very interesting use of words there.
Now, what he says, and he's pretty adamant about this, is that what they were doing in 1917 was saving the town from what was inevitable bloodshed. And here's a moment when you get a sense of just how adamant he is about all of this.
It was not an anti-immigrant move. It was not a labor-busting move. It was, let's make our community safe for the women, for the children, for the mines. Let's support the war effort in Europe, our sons that we sent over.
Talk about him. I just where he is, because he seems at times completely adamant about this, that this was the right thing to do.
I think he believes it was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
I mean, there's another important line in the movie where he says, there was going to be blood on the streets. My grandfather told me there was going to be blood on the streets. And he says he heard stories of what the miners were going to do to the strikers. So in his mind, this was protecting Bisbee, and it was protecting those strikers, which is a very complex thing. But just keep in mind, as his daughter, Annie Graham Larkin, who is – it's not said in the film, but she's one of the best historians in town and one of the smartest people about talking about the deportation, one of the most careful historians, and really tries to understand the complexity and what a bystander might think if confronted with some of these conflicting propagandistic reports and all the things that, you know, what it means to be in a mining town. But, you know, he's a lifer,
yeah.
you know, so
yeah.
he worked from the bottom of the bottom in the mines. He saved a man's life in the mines. He saved a man who he hated's life in the mines,
wow.
which he's fond of telling. And then he worked his way up, and now he lives in Peru, and he's made his entire life on being someone who is a believer in the mines and believer in mining. He has a mineral, and I regret that this isn't the film because it's so beautiful. He has a mineral called graphite that he discovered. So the mining and the minerals and what it means to be a miner are in his blood. So when someone is trying to shut that down, and especially when, you know, if you're a patriotic American and you think that, you know, whatever your politics are, once you send the boys over to Europe and they're dying in the trenches and these, you know, rabble-rousers, these wobblies are in town trying to shut down the mines, you would do anything to stop that because it meant the existence of your town and supporting people being killed for what you – what everyone – you know, not everyone. No, sorry. Most people did not support World War I. It's a lost fact of history that Americans did not support the war until we entered the war, until the propaganda machine really turned things
up. Huge isolationist movement at the time.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Woodrow Wilson, I mean, you know, the comparisons between Woodrow Wilson and Trump can be made. So, I mean, he was called a fascist at the time and a warmonger and all these things. And he was trying to manipulate the public in very specific ways. And when he says, my grandfather told me to, so that's what he's talking about.
There's an amazing moment when Dick Graham – is playing Walter Douglas. Now, just to quickly explain who Walter Douglas is.
So Walter Douglas was the head of Phelps Dodge. Yeah. And the Douglas family is the reason why Bisbee exists. Walter Douglas, his father, was the sort of the founder of the town. Everyone loves him. Walter, on the other hand, most people dislike intensely. He was kind of like took the family name and buried it a little bit. And he was the mastermind behind the deportation. Right. Never admitted it. Never was charged. Also, friend of Woodrow Wilson. So had connections, as they say.
So Dick is playing Walter Douglas in your recreation, and that he went along with you is pretty remarkable, I have to say. And then there's this moment, the scene where he talks about how he can relate to Walter. I can relate to him. I know this. And then so they play this scene, and there's this moment when you ask him how he's thinking about it. And I want to play that. But would you set that up for us a little bit? Because this is kind of a lovely, intense moment, I have to
say.
Yeah,
we wanted to do a sort of Ghost of Christmas Past, Present, and Future kind of thing with Dick playing Walter Douglas. And we knew that he considers Walter Douglas a great man. He's not alone in that. But he considers him a great man because in his mind, just very quickly, in his mind, Walter Douglas did all these good things and no one talks about that. All they do is talk about, you know, and this is a common thought, you know, for business people and people who support business people, right? We do all these good things, but all you see is this.
Yeah.
And they think that, you know, that's unfair. And there's something to be said for that argument. So we asked, you know, Dick to basically dress up in a nightgown and be sleeping wherever Walter Douglas might have been sleeping. It's in fact filmed in the Copper Queen Hotel, which is haunted. And we had singers sing to him "Solidarity Forever," and we wanted to sort of see what that provoked. And he was very happy, gleeful even, to come do that scene.
How can I change it? How can I change it? How can I show the truth? How can I show the light? How can I show the suffering that has been alleviated by the many, many things we are doing, the great many things we have done, but most importantly, what we can do together in the future. But we must do it together. Just as we won the West, we can build the future. You hit a point where you have to make a decision between what is right and what is legal. They are not always the same. And you must always do what is right.
That is chilling.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he believes those words. And what's interesting about that scene for me is it lays out that this isn't about 1917. It's not even about 2017. It's about the history of this country. At another point, he says, this is why I was against the protest of Vietnam. And he says, you know, just like it's – the words he uses reveal the narratives of this country. When he says, just like we won the West. Well, if you're not white, winning the West was a massacre. And you must always do what is right. That is a common sort of ideological underpinning of a lot of decisions on the right and the left, in fact. Both sides have sort of, you know, and even that narrative right there, both sides, those words, both sides, it's damaging. But of all ideologies have used that idea that you have to do what is right and forget what is legal. And he's admitting there, of course, that he believes that the deportation was right, but it wasn't legal.
Let's talk about Fernando Serrano. I almost think that another title for this film could have been The Education of Fernando Serrano in some ways, because it's about his waking up almost. How did you find Fernando? Talk a little bit about him.
I'll say to start that even that is – hopefully it's more complicated than that, because the truth is he had it in him the whole time.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's our role to wake him up, but I hope people see that as a complex question.
Well, I don't think you woke him up, but – but the sense is that he became – because of his involvement in this, and he says it in the film, he became aware of things that he hadn't really thought of deeply. They were in him.
Yeah, clearly.
Yeah.
And he might have been burying them to be healthy. And that's the question – that's some of the sort of more ethical, you know, tricky questions that the film hopefully brings up for people, is maybe he should have kept these buried. And I'll talk about that in a second. But Fernando – is extraordinary in the film and is become one of my favorite human beings that I've ever met. And just because of his he has a light in him that's just beautiful. The way we met him, it actually just proves that directors don't always know what they're talking about. Because when we first went there in October of 2016, we were just doing some test things that some of them ended up in the film. But I imagined a big, burly miner. You know, I'd met so many burly men who had been miners, and we reached out to a couple of people to help us find someone, and we were sent this picture of this beautiful man, Fernando. And my producer, Bennett Elliott, saw that and said, he's perfect. And I said, too skinny, too little, too young. And she's like, you're crazy. We're definitely using him. And that changed the course of my life, probably.
Wow.
Because he's the star of the movie, and he's the emotional center of the movie in many ways. And he absolutely. I mean, what after all the dust has settled, we've figured out is the trauma of his mother being deported, and the trauma of being gay, and sort of trying to find yourself. He found this sort of armor of positivity that made it so he didn't think about politics. He didn't think about the word solidarity. He didn't think about things like that. And by the end of the film, I think it's good to see the awakening as a positive thing. I think it is positive. But by the very end of the film, and I don't want to give it away, he becomes the ghost, and maybe he's trapped as a ghost. And for me, that's not an easy answer. I mean, maybe when we learn our past, we're empowered by that. But we're also haunted by that. And I think that's a complex thing. And I think Fernando sees it as a positive thing, and I'm very grateful for that. But I wasn't always so sure. And I hope that, you know, that tension is in the film.
Here's a moment. This is early on, before he's really involved in the recreations, just talking a little bit about how he's thinking, again, early on in his thinking about all of this.
You know, I had never even heard about the deportation till I met you guys. And I've been living here my whole life. But it was something that I wasn't really interested in. You know, like, I wouldn't consider myself politically active. It just seems like a lot of fighting. A lot of fighting.
He says you have to process your anger. You can't act on your anger. I mean, he's just so contained and composed in some ways. And I think that this transformation in the process of playing this role is remarkable.
He like I said, I think it's healthy that he figured out a way to process his anger. I hoped it's healthy that he also figured out a way to connect to something else. There's all kinds of ways of health. And I'd love to ask him myself. I think the crazy thing about doing a film this quickly is we don't know yet. We don't know what this all means yet. I mean, this is not like a film where we filmed over 10 years or something. I mean, we were done filming in July, which is less than 6 months ago. We were editing the film until a week before Sundance. And so we're still in the process of figuring out what this all means and how it all really will land, not just with Fernando, but with everybody in town.
Do you have a sense now then what this did to the town? I mean, one of the things I read from you was that you hoped that this would change people in some way.
I think the people who were involved in the film feel like they went through something, and that something is healthy. I think that, and like I said, I'm very grateful for that. Our process is very collaborative, and so I think people felt empowered.
There's this one moment I'll just mention where somebody says toward the end of the recreation, this was the largest group therapy session ever or something.
Yeah, and it's important for me for that part of the film for not – I don't want the audience to think that we're saying that because I don't know if it was group therapy. And I certainly think for the white guy saying that, it might have been group therapy. But for other people, it might have been traumatizing. And I don't think that that's not answered.
No, it doesn't tidy things up. At the end. That's good to say.
I think it's important to recognize that these kinds of interventions can sometimes take you in directions you don't want them to take you. But we embrace that. I mean, we embrace that when we talked to people from the beginning and said, this is what we want to do. This is how we want to do it. And we're not sure. You tell us. I mean, that's the beauty of documentary. As much as I'm fond of intervening and creating, you know, moods and telling stories and creating characters and doing all that stuff. The thing I love about documentary is that you don't know. And you don't have the power to know. And you have to sort of give yourself up to the chaos of reality and figure it out. And we're still figuring it out.
Let me play one more moment from the film. This is Doug Graham. This is Dick's son. And this is during the recreation when you go through the actual a moment when you're the deputies are putting these people in the cattle cars, and so you can hear the commotion in the background, and then you pull him out and you do this interview with him in the front of all of this, getting him to kind of react. Let me play this, and I want to ask you about it because I think it's interesting what he says.
Yeah, it's really questioning whether it should be done or not. Back in the time, it was probably different feelings on it, but with today's values and today's ideals, it shouldn't be happening. In today's world, you know, you don't, this is not how you handle your issues. You don't load with armed, just vigilante style justice and throw them in boxcars and send them off. I gotta admit, my family is on the side that I'm on right now. But that's using then values, and, you know, and the world's changed a lot since then.
The world's changed a lot since then. Has the world really changed a lot since then? I got the sense that the world hadn't changed at all since then. I mean, in some ways.
I think Doug's world changed. I mean, when we came to town, Doug Graham, who runs the mining tour, his father was president of the mine, and his family was on the side of the deporters. We were told by several people, you do not mention the deportation on the mining tour.
Wow.
You don't talk about it because we don't talk about it. Because, you know, why would you do that in how is that going to mess up the tourist, you know, thing that's the only thing that can pay the bills in town? Yeah. And that Doug is the sort of Doug who, you know, is living the minor dream of taking care of this mining tour, which you see in the film is a active job every day. And we were told, you know, don't talk about it. As we got closer to the Graham family, I told the producers, I said, here's a dream of mine. I'd like to have Doug as a deputy dragging Fernando down the street, which mimics stories or sort of recreates stories that we had heard of Mexican men being dragged down the street. And I talked to him about it, and I talked to him about why him and why we wanted to do it. And I think he understood it. So that scene is taking place on the rail bed where this happened. We built a cattle car. He's standing in front of that cattle car holding his gun. And he's saying, this has changed. And I think what he's meaning to say, if I could interpret, because he's not a guy who wants to talk about his feelings, I'll tell you that much. After I showed him the film, he said, yeah. And that's all I got.
Right.
I think what he's meaning to say is, I hope that this is different now. because, you know, those values that were defined by my family agreed with those values of making this decision to, in vigilante style, pull people and throw them in the cars. I hope that that's over. And that's what I think he's saying.
So how many, finally, how many of the people in the film have seen it yet? What's the general reaction if there is one?
We brought it to Bisbee, and actually we took it out of Bisbee because there's Sierra Vista's 45 minutes away, and we knew to play it in Bisbee, we wouldn't be able to keep people out. So we wanted to just play the film for the people who were in the film. And we filmed with a lot of people who didn't make the final cut, as these things go.
Sure.
It was an incredibly emotional – they looked at a rough cut in a movie theater, and it was one of the most emotional screenings I've ever had. And I think they saw finally – I mean, a lot of times what happens with my films is I kind of sort of explain the concept, and people just kind of trust me, and which I'm thankful for, and they have no idea how this is going to come together.
Yeah.
It seems cheesy. It seems this. And then when they see the way – you know, what we were kind of after, they got it. And – like, for instance, Charles Bethay, who does the voiceover of his – that's his radio show that he allowed us to use and re-edit. Imagine yourself having your words taken and turned into voiceover. And I was just so honored that he was moved to tears. You know, he said we took his words and made them mean even more. The people who participate in this very much care about this story. And I think they believe that what we did was right and helpful in getting it out.
Robert Greene. Next Tuesday night, we're going to be showing his documentary film, Bisbee 17, as part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. It's at 7 o'clock at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. Robert Greene will be there for a Q&A after the screening. We have details about it on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.